Hello and welcome to The Urbanist here on Monocle 24, the show all about the cities we live in. Standing in for Andrew Tuck this week, I'm Thomas Lewis. Coming up on this week's programme, we take an in-depth look at ideas of well-being in our cities today from the inaugural Wellbeing City Summit in Montreal. We'll hear from some of the speakers at the event, including the founder and former CEO of Zipcar on her newest venture, a think tank aimed at reimagining ideas of mobility in our cities today.
I think there's a lot of demand for these new mobility modes. It's really changed how people feel about sharing cars or taking multimodal trips.
And we'll speak to the mayor of Santa Monica on how a new index pioneered there is cracking open our notions of well-being.
Now with the Well-being Index, we ask a whole series of questions. And it measures everything from kindergarten readiness among our very youngest citizens to whether or not our senior community is feeling isolated.
All that, and we'll hear from the director of the Storied Neighborhood Design Center in Baltimore on how to reimagine a city from the bottom up.
The projects are highly varied, from small individual vacant lots that are being adopted by community members in a neighborhood, all the way up to community master plans and transportation plans.
Plenty to feel well about then over the next 30 minutes here on this well-being edition of The Urbanist with me, Thomas Lewis. Well-being is a broad church of a phrase. In an urban context, it's usually been tied to the physical health of a city's residents and how to improve it. How much physical activity do city dwellers get? How clean is the air that we breathe there? How do you improve access to things that make us, as city dwellers, physically healthier? From hospitals to gyms to neighbourhood doctor's surgeries. But that idea is being revisited as our understanding of how to live and how to live well in an urban environment broadens to include the social, economic and cultural aspects of city life too. Well, to begin our look at well-being in cities, I spoke to Anne Arts of the Novartis Foundation, which was one of the co-hosts of this year's inaugural Wellbeing City Summit in Montreal. She began by telling me about a project that sought to address the idea of physical well-being by taking medical provision outside the doctor's surgery.
What we set out to do there was we wanted to improve the cardiovascular health of the urban populations because it's the number one problem in those settings now. And we said, okay, we can do the healthcare side. We can improve the quality of healthcare. We can improve the prevention. But the problem was that health systems are insufficiently prepared to address the needs of chronic patients. So what we then looked at is how can we bring health and care outside of the systems. So we worked with local businesses, for example, in Ho Chi Minh City, where barbershops, manicure salons, post offices, marketplaces are now screening for chronic diseases. And they offer that screening for free to their customers. So on the one hand, we have customers that are happy because they know their health status and can be linked to the health system for further follow-up. That is then guaranteed by a digital platform. And the shopkeepers are very happy because they increase their foot traffic and their business because it's attractive. So with that, it was very successful in a city like Ho Chi Minh City, where 1 in 3 people have, for example, high blood pressure. We found that only a handful of people were currently aware of their condition and were receiving treatment for that. So with this screening outside of the system, in the shops, the number of people under treatment increased drastically to about 70% of people who are with hypertension now controlled, their blood pressure is controlled. And with those data, the government now is integrating that kind of working through non-traditional health players, but enterprises, small shops, they integrate that into the national health policy. And that is a beautiful story, I believe.
Anne Arts there of the Novartis Foundation speaking to me at the Wellbeing City Summit in Montreal back in June. The United Nations projects that close to 70% of the world's population will live in cities by 2050. That poses a particular challenge for city transport networks, which have undergone no small upheavals over the past 2 decades or so. Among those companies that disrupted city transport offerings when it launched nearly 20 years ago was Zipcar. The car-sharing membership model, founded in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the year 2000, pioneered much of the sharing economy that has woven itself into most aspects of city life now. It was co-founded by Robin Chase, who told me about how notions of mobility in cities are changing.
So the idea is, how quickly can we get cities around the world to channel the disruption that we're seeing in the transport sector to create cities that are active and shared mode dominant, to switch the dominance in cities from cars to these other modes?
And how quickly can that be done?
We're going to be doing it in 5 to 10 years. That's what I think, we can do it. The technology is there. I think there's a lot of demand for these new mobility modes. It's really changed how people feel about sharing cars or taking multimodal trips. And we can repurpose that road infrastructure. And so I actually think it can happen quite quickly. I've really been struck right now by this number that 50% of all trips are less than 3 miles or 5 kilometers. And if we think about that, what are those short trips? It is to take your child to and from school, to or from soccer, shopping, doctor's visits, friends. There's no reason why we can't transform those trips into these active mode trips, walking, biking, electric biking, scootering, if we felt safe. I mean, it's so much faster and more nimble than your car, period. Even if you live in a suburb, it's faster to get on one of these things and nip down the sidewalk or nip down the street to get there. So I think that if we can make it safe and we can get people to try electric bikes or bikes, I think we will have huge success. I really feel like electric bikes are a crazy transformation right now that's really making people think differently and will cause different types of demand for bike lanes. So it's not just those young environmental athletic types who want active modes, that these electric bikes are suitable. I'm really thinking a lot about pilots these days. And pilots are a great way to move the political will and the community will. We have all these ideas about what we don't like and how it'll never work and how it'll cause problems. And pilots are a method to say, hey, you know what? This is an experiment. We're going to try it. And if we don't like it, we can undo it. And if we get something wrong, we can improve it. And those trials, if they're done well, with solutions that we know actually are good solutions, they definitely sway public opinion to the other direction, and then people don't want them taken away.
Are you finding increasingly that actually it is, say, an entrepreneur with a sort of get-up-and-go spirit who wants to try out scooter sharing or electric bikes or whatever it might be that kind of need to set the ball rolling? Or are you seeing governments waking up a little bit and not being so scared of trying to sort of be more imaginative, I guess, about what their network looks like?
For entrepreneurs, I think they can and they will, and I want to encourage them to definitely try things out. What has gotten cities terrified is how Uber and Lyft and then the shared dockless bikes at huge scales completely outran what cities could respond. And I also want to blame the venture capital community and maybe the tax laws in the U.S. that caused huge sums of money to be invested in these crazy projects that were not ripe for such rapid expansion. So the pace at which those things expanded without the ability to modulate was a challenge, and that's caused cities now to go the opposite direction.
Going back to the Zipcar days, now looking at Zipcar, what's the effect that Zipcar had?
I am incredibly proud of Zipcar and the work that we did. Is that we, and I want to say you'll be shocked, 19 years ago, so in 2000, we saw the technology available and applied it to a problem to make a solution 10 times easier. So we really were the first ones who made it possible to rent a car for an hour because technology made that possible. And that completely unlocked a couple of things, how people think about cars or other assets as, I just want to use it, I don't want to own it. So I'd say there's a huge revolution that we started with that particular space. The idea that technology makes sharing of all kinds of assets trivial, and that people are interested in doing that, we opened that up. That venture capitalists were willing to support transportation innovation was thanks to Zipcar. That before Zipcar, transportation innovation meant you invented a new kind of Ferrari or you built a bridge. But no one really thought about innovating on the use cases of transport, and we showed that there was demand and that it was very successful. So when I'm in my proudest moments, I think Zipcar really was the cornerstone and game-changing of how cities can imagine building themselves, how people can imagine getting around, what types of businesses are possible, and what technology unlocks.
Robin Chase there, co-founder and former CEO of Zipcar. As mayoralties go, you'd think that being the mayor of a place like Santa Monica in California might be something of a plum position. Nestled along the golden beaches on the western flank of Los Angeles, it's one of the most affluent corners of the US, frequented by Hollywood's great and good, as well as well-heeled holidaymakers from around the world in equal measure. But for the city's mayor, Gleam Davis, affluence did not, she noticed, equate directly to well-being for a community that's far more diverse than the glitzy picture postcard imagery a place like Santa Monica might suggest. I spoke to Gleam Davis about the Well-Being Index, a new system she implemented to address quality of life issues for Santa Monica's residents.
Santa Monica's a beach community. It's an international tourist destination. And I think one of the misconceptions about Santa Monica is that it's a very affluent community. There's no doubt we have a number of very wealthy people in our community, but about 30% of our households live on less than $30,000 a year, which means that they struggle with things like rent, they struggle with food security, and with obtaining medical care. And so while we need to meet the needs of everyone in our community, we need to recognize that some people in our community have deeper, more important needs than others, and we need to focus on them. And that's really one of the drivers of our well-being index, is measuring our community's well-being so we know where to place our resources.
And walk us through what the well-being index is. Well-being seems to the uninitiated, I guess, to be a fairly broad church of a term and a fairly intangible thing to be able to measure, I guess. So where did the idea for the well-being index come from, and what does it do? How do you put it into practice, I suppose?
So we had a series of traumas in our community focused on youth, some gang violence as well as some suicides. And we started what we called the Youth Report Card. And the idea was really to try and measure how the youth in our community was doing, because the fact is, if you can measure something, you can improve it. And then we found out about the Bloomberg Philanthropies Challenge about solving problems in cities. And what we tried to do was take this Youth Report Card and extend it throughout our entire community. So now with the Well-Being Index, we ask a whole series of questions, and it measures everything from kindergarten readiness among our very youngest citizens to whether or not our senior community is feeling isolated. And as we continually do the index every 2 years, we can start to see those areas where we're spending some resources and whether or not we're making improvements. So we were shocked to find out when the first Youth Report Card and then the Well-Being Index came out that despite our community's affluence, less than 50% of our children entered kindergarten ready to learn across the entire scale, not just academically, but emotionally and socially. We've been putting more resources there, and we're starting to see some improvements. We also found out that a lot of our seniors feel very isolated. They feel stressed in their own homes because they're not sure they're going to be able to afford future rent increases, that sort of thing. So we have been focusing on developing more community assets where seniors can come together. For example, we do a free lunch every Wednesday in our community where any senior is welcome. They can come, and they can connect with service providers who do everything from their taxes to health screens. We also have developed a rideshare model with Lyft where they can actually ride around Santa Monica for $2 a ride and get to their doctor's appointments, that sort of thing. But more importantly, what we're finding out is these resources then on our well-being index show that our seniors are becoming less and less isolated. And that's really key to living a longer life.
When you say that the affluence of somewhere like Santa Monica is not replicated everywhere, I think it's fair to say, as the mayor of that city, does that mean that you're in a kind of enviable position? Do you have bottomless pots of cash to be able to throw at everything? Or actually, doesn't it quite work like that?
We do not have bottomless pots of cash. I wish we did. We could do a lot more. What the well-being index lets us do is say, okay, where are we falling down? Where do we need to improve our city's performance? Where do we need to spend those limited resources so that we get the most bang for our buck? And it's really been an interesting process, and one that I think has been very profitable overall for the community. One of the other things we've done is had micro grants. So we had a $500 micro grant program, and the purpose of that was to let people engage in activities that would build community. We had one woman who had raised many children in Santa Monica, lived there for years, but had never really participated in government and never really had a job. She's focused on raising her kids. They had all graduated, and so she applied for and won a micro grant of $500 to teach other women in the community how to build traditional paper flowers. Now what she has done is she has taken that, she's given a skill to other women in the community. She now has a business and business cards. People saw these flowers, and now she sells these flowers to community events. It's a community that's been underserved and that we haven't heard from, and giving them some level of economic empowerment, even if it's selling paper flowers, which are beautiful, by the way, that really makes a difference, not just in the lives of the community overall, but in this one particular family where the relationship between the husband and wife was really enhanced because he was proud of her and she felt more independent. And it was just lovely to see.
This idea of it being a, you know, international tourist destination, quite often those destinations don't really always have to have kind of a soul, because people are always going to come there anyway and then leave again afterwards. So I'm just interested to know, you know, for people who live in Santa Monica, what that element of the soul is.
Santa Monica does have a unique identity, and we struggle being surrounded on three sides by the city of Los Angeles to maintain that identity. A lot of the problems we have in Santa Monica, traffic, homelessness, increases in rents, are really regional problems that we share with Los Angeles and many of our neighboring municipalities. And so we also have to look for regional solutions to these problems.
And very quick final thought, is there anything before the term is out then, therefore, that's in your sights that you'd like to see get done?
So one of my goals in my year as mayor was really to promote this concept of well-being. All of our council is invested in it, but I have really taken the leadership role. And so one of the things I really wanted to do was create a well-being summit. And we now have that on schedule for the second weekend in November. And I thought that the summit was important for a couple of reasons. First of all, because when we talk about well-being, a lot of people don't know what that means. And so they think, oh, you're trying to make me happy, and there's nothing local government can do to make me happy. Or it's about mental health. Well, I'm fine there. Or it's about physical health. And it's really so much more fundamental than that. It's really about looking at our community and finding that connectedness so that people do have someone they can share great sorrow or great joy with, someone they can go to in an emergency, so that they have a circle of friends, but more importantly, that they feel engaged with the larger community as a whole. Well-being is a fundamental part of who we are as a community. As our Declaration of Independence in the United States says, the fundamental issues are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if I can accomplish that, I will have done a great deal and be very proud of my year as mayor.
Gleam Davis, the mayor of Santa Monica there. This is The Urbanist on Monocle 24 with me, Thomas Lewis. In a general election in Sweden last year, a wearily familiar pattern appeared to emerge. Centre-right and centre-left political parties saw their support dwindle, while those parties at the extremes of the political spectrum did well. Part of the shift appears to have been anchored in immigration, a conversation that has become divisive in Sweden as it has in other European capitals and in the United States. As the often shapeless suspicion of newcomers continues to be politically potent, might it be at a city level that attitudes can change in tangible ways? Nina Miskovsky is the deputy mayor of the city of Gothenburg, and she appears to think so.
Gothenburg is a wonderful city. I've been living in other cities around the world, but I always decided to come back to Gothenburg. For me, it's a medium-sized city. It's about 570,000 people. It has everything, but it's not too big. It's kind of personal, but still have the service that I'm looking for in a big city. It's a very friendly city. It's also a quite segregated city, as we're starting to have the same problems as many other cities. We have taken a lot of migrants lately, and it's a challenge with the integration part. But we have great initiatives to improve the whole chain, so to speak, to get them. A lot of it is focused on employment, of course.
You say you're focused on employment for new arrivals to Gothenburg. Give us some more details of that.
Yeah. We have collaborations between the city, with the civil society, as well as private companies and the region as well. In the civil society, they have a lot of work initiatives, like job training programs and such. And the companies, the private companies and the city, provides practical job training at work, so to speak. We have, for example, a great example of I don't know what you call it in English, but it's where you make the big ships and boats, and they also repair those things. It's huge, and it has a lot of people from We even have a problem with addiction of different kind that have newly arrived to Sweden or have some psychological problems and such. But it's a great place where people come together. The leadership is wonderful there. They really make them feel welcome, but they have discipline at the same time. And they do reach a high rate of success in getting people actually into work that has been far away from employment before.
How do you feel from your vantage point in Gothenburg? What's the mood like, I suppose, in terms of welcoming people from elsewhere, given that I suppose it's such a divisive issue in lots of other cities and lots of countries more broadly around the world at the moment?
Well, for me, it's a personal question because my parents are from different countries. My father was a political refugee from Czech Republic, and my mother, she's from Finland. But I'm born in Sweden. My child is half Jamaican. So for me, it's multicultural and integration has always been a part of my life. Therefore, I think it's so important that we have a system that works, and we haven't had that in place, to be honest. There's been stops and blocks in many places. The waiting times to get your permission to stay or that you're not supposed to stay has taken too long. People get passive waiting. There's a lot of room for improvement. We also didn't have border control. So when the mass migration happened, it was just open borders, and people who actually were not supposed to stay legally got to stay, and now the law is kind of in a limbo for those people. I think the system has been indecisive and inefficient, in my opinion, and that's what we have to pay for now, and that is a lot of the reason behind the racism that's growing even in Sweden, because it's actually, we shouldn't be angry at the people coming. We should be angry at the system who is not working. For me, fairness is and being just to people is important. So I think the most part is on the government level of the country, but we have to address the issues locally as well. We need to be more tolerant and open up our society for different cultures more. I think we need more creative thinking and more thinking possibilities instead of we can't do this, we can't do that because of the whatever rules and such. We need to think broader, and we're also missing in a lot of cities in Sweden, we're missing a city plan for the city as a whole and a very long term. We have gone quite a bit, but there's still far to go.
Nina Miskovsky, Deputy Mayor of Gothenburg, speaking to me at this year's Wellbeing City Summit in Montreal in June.
Baltimore is burning. After a day of looting and rioters clashing violently with police, tonight a community center in flames lights up the city as police and community activists try and take back the streets.
The riots in Baltimore in 2015 following the death of Freddie Gray, an African-American man who died while he was in police custody, cast a sharp light on the racial divides that still exist in many US cities. But 40 years before the upheaval caused by Freddie Gray's death, another round of social unrest in Baltimore spurred a group of architects to set up an organization that set out to bridge some of those divides through the design of the urban environment. The Neighborhood Design Center was founded in Baltimore in 1968 in the wake of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Jennifer Gould is its executive director, and she explains now how effective its mission has been in the 50 years or so since it was established.
The Neighborhood Design Center is a nonprofit organization. We were founded in 1968 by a group of architects who were inspired following the rioting in our city in response to the murder of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to look for ways to partner with communities to bring their own vision to life and to garner investment for those community-driven visions.
And what have some of those community-driven visions, what are the fruits that they have borne, if you like, over the years?
Since 68, we've worked on over 3,000 projects in the primary jurisdictions where we work, which are Baltimore, Maryland, and Prince George's County, which is a suburban county adjacent to Washington, D.C. And the projects are highly varied from small individual vacant lots that are being adopted by community members in a neighborhood, all the way up to community master plans and transportation plans. Recent history, a couple of success stories would include the neighborhoods all along North Avenue Avenue in Baltimore City joined together to do a community-based transportation plan, which was then adopted by our City Department of Transportation and taken for federal funding. And we currently just received $27 million in federal funding to redo the entire bus system along North Avenue, to cut transit times in half by prioritizing transit, as well as doing a bunch of streetscape that will make the corridor walkable and bikeable. At a much smaller scale, examples would include working with longtime urban farmers to identify the needs within their farm space to make those spaces more inclusive of the neighborhoods around them. So it could be very small things like community work days and all the supports that they need for that, new fencing, picnic tables, all the sort of amenities that make spaces pleasurable and easy to use for the communities that live there.
What kind of moment is Baltimore in at the moment, would you say?
So I've lived in Baltimore since 93, so pretty much my whole adult life. And I've seen it make a lot of change over that time. It has an amazing heart. The people of Baltimore are incredibly thoughtful and genuine and care about each other deeply for the most part. I see moments of kindness and communication almost constantly walking in the streets of Baltimore. And the people that we work with in neighborhoods that most people would say are utterly unlivable, there are many people there working tirelessly with very open hearts to make their spaces wonderful. Since the uprising in 2015, there's a lot of soul searching going on. And the city has been working hard to undertake actions that could bring greater equity to investment in the city. But at the same time, with change, there's a lot of upheaval as well. Some of your listeners may realize that our mayor has just had to step down under controversy about how she was getting some of her income as well as campaign finance, and that sort of systematic unfairness is experienced by people in the city at all levels, you know, that certain people have the connections and the wealth to get things done, and the everyday citizen is really often left to do it themselves.
Is there a sense of momentum in Baltimore at the moment if corners of the city are being repopulated, if younger people are sort of coming and giving Baltimore a go, I guess? What's the energy like, I guess, in Baltimore at the moment?
The energy is quite good. There are pockets of places where the quality of life is remarkably high. It's incredible value. So if you are a person that likes that DIY culture and likes to have some extra resources and time to be able to undertake other things besides work and sleep, it provides a remarkably high quality of life in those aspects. So, you know, I'm part of many networks who are doing just so many beautiful projects and, you know, starting maker spaces, undertaking nightly big bike rides. Street art culture in Baltimore is amazing. The food culture in Baltimore is amazing. So you can open a restaurant with a far lower barrier to entry and get a lot of attention and community around that restaurant. So there's just, I think, a lot more freedom to become your true self, I would say, in parts of the city that make it a really rewarding place to get to know people and be involved, much better than any other city I've lived in.
Jennifer Gould, Executive Director of the Neighborhood Design Center in Baltimore there, drawing this well-being edition of the program to a close. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello in Los Angeles and edited by David Stevens in London. To play us out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Always with their ode to a dream unfolding and perhaps ebbing too in an urban setting. This is Dreams Tonight. I'm Thomas Lewis. Andrew Tuck will be back very soon, but for now, thank you for listening, City Lovers. If I saw you in the street.